Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 28th day of February 2020. A Friday, yes, and traditionally the last day of February, the month that you always feel screwed when you pay your monthly bills. Like when you pay rent, you're like, wait, I only got 28 days out of this rent check. Some months I get 31 days out of. What the hell? But this year you get an extra day out of February, whether you wanted it or not. Leap day. That's tomorrow. Anyway, I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening, tuning in, pressing play, telling a friend, doing all that good stuff that you guys do. I appreciate the hell out of it. I'm coming to you live, not really, on tape, from my basement, wearing a gecko mask and cape, because Quinn has insisted on it. That's right, Quinn. You did this to your father. I literally am. I'm wearing a... Hello, Quinn. What does Daddy look like?
I lost Catboy's helmet.
All right, we'll find Catboy's helmet for you in a minute. She's going to dress up as Catboy, and I'm dressed up as Gecko. And we're going to do who knows what, hide-and-seek or something. Anyway, it is the interview edition of the program, so we've got a guest lined up for today that we already recorded with. It is Yuval Levin. He works at the American Enterprise Institute. He is an incredibly smart guy. It was a great interview about his new book, and you can learn how to enter to win a signed copy of his book at the end of the interview. Before we're going to go right to the interview, but before we get there, I just want to say about the about CPAC. I was at CPAC today. I went back, was there for a few hours, and it was enough. I just couldn't do it. There's so many people coughing there. Not that it's coronavirus, but every year at CPAC, there's always somebody who goes, I paid, I'm going, even though I've got the flu. So it was nice that nobody really wanted to shake hands. Coronavirus does have some side effects. I want to say thank you to the people that I met, the people that recognized me. I don't know how you hell you recognize somebody from a little picture on a podcast, but they were very cool, and there was a surprising number of them. So thank you for that. And all the nice emails that I got over the last hour. I didn't want to come across sounding like I was bitching, but I probably did. It's just, it gets annoying sometimes when you get emails from people. This is how you should do the show. Like, okay, do one. If it's so easy, do one. You know, you've got a lot of choices in your podcasting repertoire. There are like 100,000 podcasts or some god-awful number like that. And that you guys listen to this one is an honor. But if you don't like it, you don't have to listen to it. You should still listen to it anyway because it's good. But if you don't like it, you don't have to listen to it. If you don't like hearing from my daughter, tough. I'm going to choose my daughter every single time. So Yuval Levin, his new book, and we just pick his brain about this and the importance of institutions in the country. It was a very interesting conversation. Super smart guy. You're going to, even if you don't like it, because there'll be some things I guarantee that you won't like, that you'll be annoyed with, that you'll disagree in the interview. I think you'll learn something. I think you will think from it. So for those that reason alone, it's worth listening to. Before we get to Yuval Levin and get you on your way to your weekend, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Life Change Tea. Go to getthetea.com. Check out Life Change Tea. Pick out your flavor. Check out all the health supplements that they have. Throw them in your cart. Check them out. Look, if you buy this stuff someplace else, you can get great deals there online. The Get the Tea, the Life Change Tea, it's a month's supply. So you look at that and you go, oh, that's for a month. Drink a cup of that a day. It makes you regular. Helps give you energy. Helps your body be able to absorb more of the nutrition from the food that you consume. I drink it every day. I have about a little less than a half a gallon of it sitting in the fridge right now. Just a cup a day keeps the doctor away. Not really, but it helps keep you regular, which helps allow you to absorb more of the nutrition from the food that you eat. Try it for 1 month and you'll be convinced. Go to getthetea.com, enter promo code Derek at checkout. That not only lets them know that you heard it here and you're supporting the show and supporting sponsors of the show, but it also gets you great discounts. Promo code Derek, click the apply button, and great savings and a great product will be yours. It's just that easy. Okay, let us, oh, by the way, the Leap Day primary is for South Carolina is tomorrow. We will know and talk about it on Monday's show who won. Still looks like it's Joe Biden's to lose. If Joe Biden loses, he's screwed. And if Joe Biden loses, I'm screwed because I accidentally bet on him to win North Carolina, which is on Tuesday. But if Joe Biden wins, my odds of winning in North Carolina are good. I like them, if he wins. Anyway, you don't care how I accidentally bet. You shouldn't drink cough medicine. I didn't drink cough medicine. But don't drink and bet. Although the only time to ever be in a casino is when you're drunk. Avoid casinos. Anyway, that is it. Let's get to the Yuval Levin interview. At the end, you learn, well, you know how to enter to win signed books. There are two of them, I believe. If not, there'll be three of them. I'll figure that out when the time comes. But I believe there are two signed copies for you to enter to win. Incredibly smart guy, really easy guy to talk to, and you'll learn something, at least think. So have a great weekend. Be back here on Monday. Thank you for listening. I'll see you then. Now the Yuval Levin interview. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 28th day of February, traditionally the last day of February, but God is punishing us with one more day this election year. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the show. As always, on Friday, we drag somebody from their life into our life to try and broaden our horizons and make ourselves just a little bit smarter. Sometimes that's a tough haul. This time it is not. We are joined by Yuval Levin. He is the director of, Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also author of the new book, A Time to Build from Family and Community to Congress and the Campus, How Recommitting Our Institutions Can Revive the American Dream. And Lord knows we could use some reviving of the American Dream. Thank you for coming in. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
And I apologize publicly for screwing up last week. You're supposed to be here last week, but that was on me. First of all, congratulations on the book. I want to get into it right away because it's such a broad topic and so relevant every day. It seems to be more relevant. So to set the parameters, what do you mean by the institutions? How would you define these institutions?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a term that fundamental can be very hard to narrow down, but the book defines institutions as the forms of our common life, the shapes, the structures of what we do together. It's really, the argument starts from the simple fact that we seem to be living through a kind of social crisis. And yet, it's a crisis that's hard to diagnose using the usual measures we have of well-being. The economy is doing well, people are safe, people are healthy, and yet we feel like something's deeply wrong in American life. And I argue that that has to do with breakdowns at the institutional level, from family and community and our educational system all the way up to the national government, we have a sense that the structure of what it is we do together as Americans seems to be falling apart somehow. The public is losing confidence in our institutions and the people who run them. And I think that's the level at which to think about what's gone wrong in American life.
Before we go macro, more macro, get a little micro for a second, because it is weird. There is this disconnect towards especially the institutions and government. People are on both sides, for once, are untrusting of them. But if you look at the survey data, on a personal level, people are wildly happy, more content with their own individual lives than ever before since Gallup has been measuring it, 90%. Yep. How does that disconnect come into being when things are going as well, like you said, and people are personally feeling it and are content? Yet we look not only at government, at church, at civic organizations with this jaundiced eye.
Yeah, I mean, there's a breakdown really in the sense of how we're held together. I think we've lived through about a half century now of what you might call a politics of liberty, where both parties are arguing for who owns the term freedom. Mm-hmm. Is it a cultural thing? Is it an economic thing? Is it left or right? We're entering now, I think, a phase of our politics where both parties are going to have to explain to the public how they are also partisans of solidarity. What holds the country together? What unifies us? And there is just a sense that we're flying apart, so that even as people's own lives are doing okay, we have this intense partisanship and dysfunction in our politics. We have a culture war in every arena of American national life. We do have increased suicide rates and opioid use in ways that seem somehow disconnected from the usual measures of how are people doing. And they have to do with things that we refer to as alienation or isolation. These are fairly vague terms. They're ways of trying to reach for something that we can't quite describe. And I think oftentimes it has to do with a loss of confidence in the institutions of our society. And that loss is pretty widespread.
Where does it stem from, that loss of? Is it the Great Society? Prior to the Great Society, there were community institutions, churches, civic organizations, even just neighborhoods that would take care of a widow, a war widow, or somebody in need, help you pick up. Then the government said, I'd like a piece of that action. And they stepped in and usurped most of that, crowding out the private institutions. Could it be traced to that?
Well, I think that's part of it. And certainly, if you look at the at public opinion trends on these questions, that the decline begins in the 1970s. And it certainly, in that sense, aligns with an increasing role for government in providing some basic social services. And, you know, at the end of the day, an institution only makes sense if it serves a purpose. People don't come together just to be together. People come together because they need something or to do something together. And so it's true, when you crowd out local institutions, you create a sense of isolation. But I think we've also seen more recently a way in which people have come to think of institutions less as molds that form the people inside them to abide by a certain kind of integrity, and more as platforms, as places to stand and perform and give expression to various frustrations or culture war animosities, rather than as ways to be shaped and formed. And you see that across the range of American institutions. If you look at our politics now, members of Congress basically at this point run for Congress in order to get a better time slot on talk radio or cable news or a bigger social media following. They're not running in order to be legislators so much as they're running in order to be participants in the theater of our political culture. You see it in the presidency. You see it in the academy, where it seems like everyone's just looking for a platform. And it is very hard to trust a platform. It's much easier to trust an institution that says, we mold the people within to be a certain kind of human being. The exception to the public's loss of confidence in institutions, for example, at the national level, is the military, which unabashedly says, we mold a certain kind of human person. And that ultimately does make it easier to trust that institution, to believe that it has some idea of integrity that it actually lives by.
How did government lose its shine, its veneer? Is it a combination of over-promising by the left and under-delivering, coupled with, you know, and I hate to invoke the man's name in vain, but Ronald Reagan, government isn't the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. Those two, the failures of big government and the shining the spotlight on the failures of big government. I think most people would say, and I myself included, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Yep. But kind of what you're arguing is maybe a side effect, not that itself is bad.
We have to see it as a matter of degree. So I would say in the middle of the 20th century, Americans had too much confidence in our institutions, including our governing institutions, but not only them, too much confidence in big government, in big business, in big labor to manage the country. That sense of confidence in the 1950s, early 60s is just stunning. And it was very unusual. It's not how Americans had normally been. And so some normalization was going to happen. But I think it's gone way too far, in part, of course, because of incompetence and corruption. That happens, obviously, and makes it harder to trust institutions. But incompetence and corruption were not invented in the 1970s, right? That's been part of the human experience forever. I think one of the things that has changed is a fragmentation in our culture so that we have less of a strong, firm consensus around some core issues, mainstream consensus in American life. And we have a sense that a lot of what our institutions are for is fundamentally performative rather than formative. That's been helped along by social media. It's been helped along by a lot of cultural pressures that say to everybody, be yourself in every instance. And ultimately, some of our institutions need to say to us, not be yourself, but be better, be like this. We need some of that, right? We don't want too much. It can easily become oppressive. But we do need more than none. And I think we're getting to a place where the hold on us that our institutions have becomes too weak for them to be effective and for them to be trusted.
Why is it? I'll get to social media in a second, because I disagree to the degree to I think it's a problem. I think you think it's a problem.
Yeah.
The degree to which I think it might differ, because I think it's pretty damn big. But you mentioned the 50s and the faith in institutions back then. Economically, things were very similar.
Yes.
Employment was high. I mean, the rest of the world was in ruins. So it was, somebody had to build the things that rebuilt the rest of the world. So that helped. That can lead to a contentment and faith in other things because everything's going well for you. We're kind of in that situation now economically, yet mm-hmm. the impact and the attitude towards institutions is exactly opposite.
Yeah, so I think that's because this has to do with more than individual well-being. The other factor in American life in the 1950s, early 60s, was that the country had come out of several decades of intense mobilization around the war, around the Depression, the First World War. And it came out of that process very, very cohesive. Again, I would argue too cohesive. If you look at the culture of the late 50s, for example, it's a culture of trying to escape the oppressive burden of conformity. Everywhere you look, not just the kind of James Dean culture on the left, but read what William F. Buckley actually wrote in the first issue of National Review. And he's arguing against this culture of bigness and conformity. He's making a case for individual freedom. And the country, the culture reacted to the intense cohesion of that era with liberalization, both economic liberalization, more market orientation in the economy, and cultural liberalization, which ultimately led to fragmentation, again, to a much more diverse society. We also had much greater immigration over time. So that we're in a place now where it's true we have a strong economy and other reasons to feel good, but we are not cohesive. The country isn't held together by a sense of itself as one. And we need to push back some in that direction. I would say not as far as the 1950s, but we need to push back some in the direction of finding ways to trust the institutions of our society and to understand our society as one. And so in a lot of ways, our politics now is struggling to do exactly that, so that both on the left and right, you see different ways of trying to get there.
Do we have to find a way to trust our institutions again, or do our institutions have to find a way to earn our trust back?
It's exactly the latter. I would say the argument of this book is not that we should just get people to trust the institutions we have. The argument is that we need to help our institutions be more trustworthy. And part of that does involve our changing our expectations of them and thinking of them as existing to form the people within them to abide by a certain set of ideals and integrities. It means taking them seriously, but it, by no means does it mean that we should just trust the institutions that now govern us and now run our economy and our society. They've lost our trust for a reason.
Part of the reason for the loss of trust in such institutions is, and I heard you doing some research for this interview, you talked about the way, and it's something I've railed about and written about in my columns, the
Congress has ceded power to the executive. Yes. Rather than writing explicit laws, which if you've ever read legislation, first of all, I'm sorry, don't ever do that again. But if you want to punish a child without beating them, make them read the Medicare Modernization Act, which is what I had to do at one point. It's terrible. It's just awful. But in there, they, instead of being explicit, they say in a manner determined by the secretary.
That's right.
In a manner determined, shall, may, yep, whatever it is. And that, people think of that as fairly innocuous, but that is Congress explicitly ceding power to the director of HHS in the case of Medicare modernization, that they can make up, fill in the blanks. You fill in the blanks however you decide to do it, which also leaves it open to the next administration coming in and wildly changing, yep, things without any legislative action or accountability to elected officials. That helps perpetuate a lack of faith in institutions. Mm-hmm. But that power, once ceded, can it be clawed back by, yeah, Congress?
Yeah,
and,
look,
and will they want to? Because there are political consequences
for really
doing
that. That really is the problem, right? So I think the core problem is Congress is weak now because the members want it to be weak. And they prefer to think of their job in performative terms. They think they are there to channel and express the frustration of their voters, especially with Congress. And most members now just spend a lot of their time basically performatively expressing outrage about Congress. A lot of it is performance, in part because the institution has become totally transparent. And I think there have to be some closed spaces for members to actually legislate. If you go to a congressional hearing now, and I don't really recommend that either, you'd find individuals producing YouTube clips. That's right, basically what happens at these hearings, rather than anybody trying to work together towards some legislative outcome. I think a lot of the problems that we complain about as conservatives, like the overreach of the administrative state, the overreach of the judiciary, are actually functions of underreach by Congress, willful, intentional underreach. Congress doesn't want the responsibility it's given under the Constitution, and it signs it away. It seems to me that the only way to claw that back, there's room to do that constitutionally. Congress could do it if it wanted to. But the question is how to get members to want to. And I think that has to happen through a set of institutional reforms that gives members of Congress more of an investment in the work of the institution. Break the budget process down into much smaller pieces.
You mean just governing by continuing resolution isn't the key to success?
Exactly. One vote a year, you know, it's not enough, especially if you didn't read the bill and had nothing to do with writing it. So change for our national government has to begin with reform of the Congress. That is just absolutely the essential first step.
But will they ever reform themselves? Because with responsibility comes accountability, and they are there to perpetuate their own jobs.
Yeah, look, I think that you have to start from the fact that many of them seem unhappy with their job. And begin there and ask them, well, you could do something about this. What should that look like? But yeah, it will require a change of attitude that would have to be pretty profound. And there's no question that a lot of members now have lost sight of what the job really could be, and of what their responsibility is under the Constitution. What it means to think institutionally about a role like that is to think about the responsibilities given to you by the structure of the institution. And we're seeing failures to do that across the range of American life.
You mentioned members of Congress playing to an audience, trying to build a social media footprint. I was press secretary for Senator Conrad Burns of Montana in 2006 until the voters had other ideas. In his farewell address, he advocated for removing the C-SPAN cameras from the Senate, and from the chamber at least, because members, he said, before them, we actually discussed things. We had debates on the floor, and that was gone because Dick Durbin, just to pick a name because I've witnessed this firsthand, will stand there on the floor of the Senate and talk like this because the camera's on a pole 15 feet high.
Yeah.
They do not talk to one another. Yes, hearings are 4-minute and 30-second speeches with 30 seconds left for maybe an answer from the person they're supposedly questioning to make the social media footprint. But in many ways, social media has taken what C-SPAN did to Congress and did it to all of us.
Exactly.
Social media is wildly important, and I hope you Facebook and tweet this this episode. But the net positive, net negative. We've never been more connected, but we've never felt more isolated. People have phones. My phone is sitting right here. 9 times out of 10 when I pick it up, actually probably 99 times out of 100,
right,
I don't use the phone function. I don't actually talk to a human being, even when communicating with another human being. So
yeah,
the disconnect that connectivity brings about, how do we eschew convenience for community, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's an enormous problem. And there are a lot of ways in which social media has exacerbated the challenges that we're already confronting our institutions because it encourages this performative outlook on what it is we're doing in life. Social media means that basically we're all functioning now as our own paparazzi, right? Hounding ourselves for photographs, stealing away our privacy in return for some kind of bizarre exposure. And it forces us to think in weird ways about what we're doing.
Well, so a meal didn't really happen unless you put the picture on Facebook,
right?
Did it?
Everything becomes a form of expression, and that just makes it harder for us to actually have inner lives and social lives. Now, I don't think social media is going away. And the question for us is, what can we build around it so that we change our habits some? We're new to this. We're new to a social media world. We're still learning how to live with it. A lot of people, I think a growing number, are dissatisfied with it, which would suggest that there's a niche for people who want to offer them a better way to use it. So maybe we can hope that there are ways of making the most of the advantages of social media that let us avoid some of the disadvantages. But at this point, it is a tremendous net negative for our social lives, for professionalism, for our political culture, for a lot of what matters in our country's life.
Where has the breakdown of institutions had the most profound impact? And I just want to set this up. And I know I know I get the emails. I talk too long into the questions, but tough. There was a time, is it the family or is it community, I guess would be the question, because there was a time when I was a kid, I'm out riding bikes with my friends. It didn't matter where I was, a 1 square mile thing, that busy roads were my boundaries. They were my prison walls. And no matter what I did, I had to look around because somebody saw me doing it, it would get back to my parents. The community was looking out for all of us. Now, the way community has been redefined, it's based on your sexuality or your gender identity or your skin tone, where I just say the left, I'm a conservative person, the left would have you care more about what happens to somebody across the country who happens to have the same sexual orientation as you, rather than what happens to your neighbor who doesn't. Where is the damage done? I would put it in, I would say the community has damaged the family, and then from there it goes out to the other institutions. Yeah. But you wrote the book on it. So
well, look, I think it works in both directions. I mean, the breakdown of family forms is, I think, the cultural fact of American life of the last 7 decades. And you can trace it beginning almost immediately after the end of World War II. You start to see a breakdown of the two-parent family. And it has proceeded almost unceasingly until a kind of plateau in the last few years, where we're finding that the rates of unwed parenthood is not growing in the way that it did, but it's extremely high. That makes it very difficult to build communities, because without functional families, it's also hard to build functional communities. But I would say at the same time, there has been a breakdown in our expectations of what our communities are for and what they do for us. And as you say, we've gone from thinking of them in interpersonal terms to thinking of them much more in expressive terms, in the sense of standing for an identity, so that we look for people with whom we share certain traits rather than for people with whom we share an actual experience of life together. And that difference is a big difference. It makes it harder for us to, first of all, bridge differences of identity, where neighbors don't have to have the same religion, don't have to have the same skin color in order to understand themselves as neighbors. But if that's how you define commonality, then it becomes much more difficult for a society as diverse as ours to function. But I also think it affects trust, and therefore our trust in other institutions all the way to the national level. And so I do think the breakdown is bottom up, and it's certainly somewhere at the intersection of family and community.
You don't spare anybody in this book. You haven't spared anybody in your writings. The president of the United States certainly not going to get invited to your next birthday party, and he probably won't invite you to his. He wouldn't show up either way.
Yeah.
But and I know, I can already feel the emails. The audience of this show is very much on the pro-Trump side, certainly definitely conservative, but I'm not of the belief that he is without fault for anything ever.
Right.
But is he a perpetrator or a symptom, if you will, of the breakdown of institutions? Because it certainly didn't start with him.
Absolutely. I would say symptoms can worsen the disease so that the symptom can be a perpetrator. But certainly what we're seeing in our politics now is much more a symptom. None of this began with Donald Trump. And this is not a book about Donald Trump or that spends too much time on him. But if you think about the breakdown of a sense of institutionalism, that is an idea that what it is to have a role in our national government is not purely performative, but has to be thought of from the inside out, then certainly you have to talk about Donald Trump, who does think performatively about the presidency and very often acts as an outsider, even though he is the ultimate insider in our system of government. When you stand and tweet at the Department of Justice, even though they work for you, that suggests an idea of the role of the president that I think has not been the traditional idea. I don't think it started with Trump. Barack Obama was a very performative president, too, who understood himself as kind of putting on a show to change the culture. But I do think it is a problem, and I think we need more people in our politics generally to be willing to say that they are insiders, that this is their responsibility, rather than that there are other people who are the real insiders and that you're fighting them. When you've been elected president or a member of Congress, and this happens in Congress too, you're an insider, whether you like it or not. It's what you ran for, and it's what your responsibility is. And so I think it's important to think that way and to be responsible accordingly.
In many ways, Joe Biden is running as an insider in the Democratic Party. He named a piece of legislation. I wrote that. I did that. I was there. I was arrested at that place. I did this, that, and the other thing. And that doesn't seem to catch fire even with Democrats, although we'll find out tomorrow how that works out in South Carolina. Yeah. But there is no appetite for it. So with before we find out how we pull up from what you're describing as a nosedive, what are the consequences of not?
Yeah. Look, I think a book like this has to make an argument to change people's attitude. It is certainly not pushing on an open door to make the case now that we need to think more institutionally. And that in some ways the great unasked question in American life now is, given my role here, how should I behave? How do I think as an insider, given that this is my responsibility, whether that's in the family or the community, whether that's in Congress or the presidency? What's really missing is the desire for that. And I think the reason that that desire to be there is, as I said at the beginning, it's the absence of strong institutions is responsible for a lot of what's gone wrong in our national life. It's responsible for the fact that so many people feel alienated and isolated and feel like our country doesn't work for them. It works for somebody else. I think we each can make a difference on that front by taking greater responsibility for the roles we have in our various institutions. And again, trying to think less as outsiders complaining and more asking ourselves, where am I an insider and what difference can I make there? That's a way to start to change attitudes, because the book certainly talks about various institutional reforms that are necessary, but what holds all of them together is that in order for them to happen, the people in our institutions would have to want them to happen. And that change of attitude has to come first. Ultimately, with our elites, and the book ends up complaining bitterly about American elites, who I think in a lot of ways are behind the trouble we see. But it's also a responsibility for everybody else.
Define what you mean by elites, because you cover a lot about elites. And when the normal average person hears that, they just envision some ivory tower elite, Ivy Leaguer, looking down their nose at people who shower because of a day's hard work rather than shower before a day's work.
Well, yeah, look, some of that is true. I mean, I would say one of the ways American life has changed in the last few decades is that we actually have almost a sector of our economy that is the elite. It used to be the case, if you look at descriptions of America in the 19th century, Charles Dickens does this in his wonderful Journey of America. People noticed that the people running American businesses were actually very different from the people running American universities, who were very different from the people running American politics. They came from different places. They had different cultural backgrounds, different educational backgrounds. I think we're at a place now where we really have one elite in America, and it does run most of our major institutions, and it is shaped by our elite universities. And so there really is a way in which, exactly by pushing against the kind of WASP aristocracy and trying to be more meritocratic, we've actually created a real aristocracy in America, a real elite. And it's a pretty irresponsible elite. It thinks of itself as being legitimated by the fact that anybody can rise into it by passing a test, rather than being legitimated by some sense of responsibility, evidence of public service or an obligation to the larger society.
Or even necessarily ability, I would say.
Or ability or competence, right. So I think a lot of the problem we have is a kind of crisis of legitimacy that ultimately is a sense that Americans have that the people who run things are not responsible to them. And I think institutional reform is essential to changing that, because that is a way of imposing obligations on people with authority and power in our country.
As you set out to write this book, what was the spark? What was the moment where you said, you know what, there's more than an op-ed here. Yeah. There's more than a white paper here. This is a book.
Well, I think it did begin for me in a kind of perplexity about the crisis we're living through that, as we said, is happening in a time that on the surface seems like it ought to be a very good time. But also the sense that this move from formative to performative in how we think about institutions, where everybody seems to be standing on top of institutions rather than inside them and playing a part in the theater of our politics.
Describe what you mean with that. Like, yeah. AOC, she's a member of Congress, right. But you wouldn't know it by the way she talks about Congress, that she even has a voice in there, let alone the ability to sway people.
Yeah, she talks about it as an outsider. She talks about it, she thinks of it as a place to stand and be seen, as a place to have a particularly large social media following. And it actually turns out that's how a lot of people think about the institutions they're part of. It undoes our professions, for example. Think about journalism. The only real value of professional journalism is that it lives by a certain kind of code when it's done right, and so can make a claim to some authoritative telling of the facts. Well, a lot of professional journalists now take themselves out of the institutions that are supposed to impose that code, stand on their own on a platform in social media, and express what is some combination of their personal opinion and professional work product. And that's just a way to blur the distinction and shred any legitimacy and authority that the profession can have. I think you see that across the range of American life now. And seeing how widespread that is one thing that drove me to try to put it together.
Just as an aside about journalism, it's one of my passions, to the destruction, it's the suicide of journalism. I call it autoerotic asphyxiation, given how they're taking themselves out. I the business I'm in, you need information in the business you're in as much as humanly possible. I have my own opinions. I can seek them out separately. They used to be bifurcated. Now they're gone, where 80% of the staff at the Washington Post and New York Times are also contributors to CNN or MSNBC, right. where they're paid to give their opinions, which makes it impossible. That line is obliterated. It's not even blurred.
And what they're doing is building their own brand, their personal brand, using the institution rather than working from within the institution.
And that leads to distrust of more institutions, because if you see Maggie Haberman on CNN giving her opinion, and you know where she comes from, and then you read her story, you're going to look at it with a jaundiced eye. Absolutely. It's every bit as disinformative as disinformation itself is the mentality that she implants through her existence, for lack of a better word, journalism is so important. It has always been important, even though in the old muckraking days and the really partisan days in the founding of this country, there was still truth in there. There's no longer truth in there. When you can't get to the truth because the filter is blocking it and only giving you parts of it, the rest of what you're talking about almost seems impossible.
Yeah.
As far as rebuilding these bonds
in
community.
Now, look, there's a complicated point in that argument, which is it's certainly true that journalists had their own opinions before.
Right.
And they were probably opinions like the ones they have now. Most of them, well before this era of social media and cable TV, were on the left. But having to pretend to be objective is actually not a small matter. Being subjected to a standard, even if you don't always live up to it, still means that your failures to live up to it are experienced as a kind of hypocrisy, and you are much more likely to abide by that standard when you feel like you have to seem to be abiding by it. Pretending to be a good person is a pretty good way to become a good person. And I think the case for institution requires us to accept that, which, on the face of it seems like it's cynical. But I think it's actually a way to be realistic about human nature. That's how rules work. That's how standards operate.
But the rules and standards, when they're constantly changing, you can never abide by them because the other side gets to define it. Margaret Sullivan, The Washington Post, wrote this week that unbiased journalism, to the extent that it exists, which it really doesn't, should be put aside because Trump is such a threat to liberty. again, the high profile institutions, and there are few as reviled as it is, few as high profile as journalism, especially in an election year. Mm-hmm. So going forward, what are the prospects? You got a roadmap here in a time to build. Yeah. Realistically, you know that at the end of the yellow brick road, there's the wizard. What's the chance of Dorothy and the gang getting there in these circumstances?
Yeah, look, being realistic means being modest when you're talking about problems like this. And I don't suggest that there's some utopian scheme that's going to solve this. There's not a public policy agenda at the end of this book. But I think that we, because what's required is a change of attitude, we can begin by changing our own attitudes, and we can begin by forcing our institutions to answer to a new set of expectations, so that there should be a public demand for a different way of understanding what our institutions should be for. I think there's an economic niche, for example, in a form of journalism that does at least strive to uphold the traditional standards of the profession. I think there's something of a political niche for politicians who argue, well, all I'm going to do is just try to make good laws and solve problems. Now, I don't think we should be unrealistic about that. You're not going to transform the culture of our society that way in an instant. And I'm not arguing for a political revolution here, but I think small changes in our expectations can make a big difference. And ultimately, that beginning is up to us, to all of us.
There are serious people out there, even in Congress, although you wouldn't know it because they don't get booked on the shows. No. Mike Enzi is not going to go screaming off about Obamacare is going to kill everybody, but he can actually make a point by point rebuttal to the arguments. But Mike Enzi is not going to get on Meet the Press. He's boring. No offense, Senator, but he's boring. So how can we do any of this when it's the squeaky wheel gets the grease? We used to look at somebody standing naked in an intersection yelling at the cars as they go past as somebody who needed help. Now we say, what's their Twitter handle? I should follow them.
And that guy had to run for office.
Exactly. It may be Chuck Schumer if he loses come November. I don't know. I wrote in my book about the obliteration of the line between famous and infamous. You used to not want to be infamous, but being famous was pretty good. But now it's just get attention.
Right.
And it's sad that has reached the halls of Congress and even the upper echelons of our government and society in general. And I don't know how to turn that back. You can't put that. If there's no way to put that toothpaste back in the tube, defining the problem is one thing, but dealing with it after that is something
else. I don't think there's simply a way to put it back in the tube, and I don't think we can turn back. So I think we have to think about how to build forward around the kinds of problems we have, how to build the institutions we have in ways that try to change the incentives that people confront some. So reforming of the way the Congress works is one way to think about that. How to build new institutions to address new problems, and not to think in utopian terms about this, but in terms of how to make these problems a little less bad. This is our culture. It's our society. There are a lot of good things about it. What we're talking about here are some bad things about it, and they have to be addressed in ways that take seriously the kinds of incentives that make them happen. And so I think we have to think in modest terms about how to create spaces where it's possible to make demands like this of people in power in our society. The fact is, Americans are not satisfied with the status quo. If there's anything we can tell from the last few years of our politics, it's that there is great frustration. What a book like this tries to do is offer a kind of vocabulary, a set of concepts for how to translate that frustration into something constructive, so that while we might have to begin by draining the swamp and tearing things down, we have to then proceed by building something that will work for us. And I think to turn to that challenge is where our politics has to go next.
So get to know your neighbors. So that's a good place to start in any event. As the last question I like to ask people who come in here with books, as somebody turns the last page at night, they're ready to go to bed, drifting off to sleep, just having finished A Time to Build. What do you want to sort of stick in their craw in the morning? What do you want to be in the back of their head as they go throughout the rest of their existence after having learned
that? I mean, to me, it is that unasked question. It is that question, given my role here, how should I behave when we're facing a judgment, a moment of decision, when we're judging the quality of a political candidate or of a company that wants our business? We should ask ourselves, is this someone who thinks that way in responsible terms? Create a demand for it. I think that's the way forward.
You've all leavened the book, A Time to Build, from family and community to Congress and the campus. How Recommitting to Our Institutions Can Revive the American Dream wins the award for longest subtitle. Thank you for coming in. I'm going to ask you to sign these if you don't mind.
Sure.
And if you want to win a signed copy, just email me, derek@dailycaller.com. Let me know that that's what you want. You're just not harassing me. And if you bought a copy or you buy a copy, send me a screen capture of the receipt and you'll get entered twice. So you can't beat that. Congratulations on the book. Thank you for coming in.
Appreciate it.
Thank you guys for listening, watching, spreading. Hopefully we spread faster than coronavirus, or at least on par. Have a great weekend. We'll know who lost, more importantly, in South Carolina on Monday when we come back to you. See you then.